to talk about this event that's happening.
And one last thing. I call you not because I'm a secret agent or a dissident agent, which
thank
I am
you.
Not.
Thank you. I'm glad to hear that. Thank
I do it because I respect you, and I respect your intention to be honest, and when you're not honest, well, I'm sorry, when you're not forthcoming, you tell why you're not forthcoming. And
and you always, you know,
I believe you.
Let's face it, in the course of our conversations, you drag out a lot of information that I originally say I shouldn't be talking about, which shows you that how loquacious I can be. I'm sure I'm saying things I really wish I didn't go into and say that I'll be just like reading on the internet, totally twisted around, backwards and forwards. My tapes of my voice will be edited on a computer, and I'll be told, and it'll be made out that I said different things than I said. But hey, you know, I guess you get used to it in this business.
Yeah, listen, you can handle it.
Thank you.
Okay.
Appreciate
bye-bye.
It. Bye-bye. And you're listening to WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. Is that the call there?
Yeah.
Okay. Hang up. There we go. Great. Thanks. All right, we are on the air with our guest. Hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
This great.
Is Marcial Gonzalez, and he runs the dance program at PSRC, Public School Repertory Company. And he's on to tell us a little bit about the program that he runs there and to invite us all to the winter concert of his kids, which is tomorrow night. That's December 14th, Friday at 7:30 p.m. And the school and the concert are located in Town Hall, which is 123 West 43rd Street on the second floor. Hi, Marcial.
Hey, good morning.
Welcome to the show.
Thanks.
And I wanted to ask you just a little bit, just to set it up, about the program that you run in the school. This is a New York City public school.
It's a public alternative high school.
Okay, and it's about 200 students in the whole school, right?
Yeah, it's
so it's a relatively small school.
Yeah.
And it's in Town Hall.
It's located in Town Hall.
And tell us how the students end up in this school.
Well, originally, Joni, it was purely an alternative high school, which means basically, this is a student's last chance before they got kicked out of the high school system. And so the first 2 years of this school, they were in a basement in some other school. I believe it was Westside High, it was called then. And with bars on the windows, it was kind of a scary prospect. And then what happened was they moved. I believe it was Ellen Kirschbaum who moved the school to Town Hall because they had the space. And so what happened was one of the teachers, I believe her name is Margie Castleman, was a dancer in her youth. So she started a dance program, and then she graduated and started, she graduated from the dance program and started an acting department. And so thusly, the arts started to flourish. Well, when I came to the school, I saw the other arts departments, and I was blown away because they have a choral director, who was fantastic. And then I saw the acting department. They were really good. The dance department, when I joined, was not that strong. Actually, it's divided into two classes. And the morning class had about 6 students, and the afternoon class had about 8. And the teacher, who I actually knew very well, is a friend of mine, really didn't enjoy his job. He kind of saw it as something he can earn money with, and since he had danced many years ago, he knew he could kind of slide by in what he knew, but he really didn't enjoy it, and he invited me one day to come watch the class. And as soon as I walked into the studio, I was amazed because it's this beautifully constructed studio, all this space, very few students, and no one really enjoying themselves. And I went, wow, this is great. And then he asked...
You saw the potential.
I'm sorry?
You saw the potential.
Oh, totally. Well, when I walked in, I went, well, because I've danced all my life. So, you know, when you walk into a nice dance studio, first thing you want to do is dance. So he asked me to sub for him. He was going away on vacation for 2 weeks. And he asked. I said, of course I would. So I went in. And on my first day that I went in to teach, I couldn't get the students to leave. They would not leave. They wouldn't leave. And I said, okay, school's over. And he's like, no, please, 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 Mr. Gonzalez, can we keep on dancing? He's like, no, you have to leave. He's like, no, please. Well, anyway, word got back to the principal, and she watched one of my classes. And she said, I've never seen someone involve so many kids, you know, dance. So it's like, well, you know, this is something I've been doing. I really love doing it. So what a few years ago, what was strictly an alternative high school has flourished into an alternative art school. And when I took over my friend, was leaving at the end of the school year, he just threw it at me. He said, do you think you'd like to take over my job? Because I really don't enjoy doing it. I know this is more one of your passions. And I went, are you kidding? Yes. When I took over, in both classes, the number of students tripled. And now, starting this is my second year, and starting this year, I have in my morning class, which was just initially about 6 students, close to 30. And in my afternoon class, I have about 20. And my morning class, basically what I do is, it's an open class. It's only an hour. So anyone in the student body can take it. And all we do basically is just dance. They come in, I put on some music, I teach them choreography, and they dance. We dance. The afternoon class, I have it for almost 2 hours. And that I've made the rep dance company. So I treat them like a dance company. And I audition. To get into that, you have to audition. And I teach them a real company class every day, and we work on repertory, and I teach them choreography. I also I teach them dances from Broadway shows. I've done many Broadway tours.
Now, tell us a little bit about your background. You were with the Ballet Hispanico of New York for about eight years.
I was one of the original members of the Ballet Hispanico of New York from 1973 until 1979. And then I became a gypsy and started touring the world and everything. But I've gotten all my dance training in New York City.
Didn't you go to the Fame High School?
Yeah, I actually went to the Performing Arts High School before it became LaGuardia, which is now behind Lincoln Center. But originally we were in that old factory on West 46th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues. And way before the program or the film Fame was out. And so I auditioned to get in. We went in. And it was really a fabulous experience, but honestly, the teachers weren't the best teachers. Some of the arts teachers were teachers who had been students, gotten a degree, and then taught, but never performed. So we could feel, I knew, as a student, well, this is, they're nice and all, but I didn't feel any passion about the dance. But then one day, we had a guest teacher from the Joffrey Ballet called Paul Sutherland. And he was actually performing. He was an active artist. He was actually performing. And the difference in class was night and day, because he could offer us all this information that someone who had never performed couldn't. And that's when my passion for all of this really started, because he was a male teacher teaching with his passions. And so when we found out he was with the Joffrey Company, we ran to see the Joffrey Company, and I was really inspired by them. They really touched something in me, and I knew this was something I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So not too long after that, I went to the Ballet Hispanico Studios, and they gave me a scholarship, and I started with them. And within the year, I was about 17, I joined the company. I joined them full-time, left school, got my high school diploma later, and started touring with the company. We toured the states, and we did several New York seasons here. And the opportunities to work with New York choreographers at the time was high. We were devastated by the specter of AIDS as of yet. So I worked with all these fabulous people who just came in and who knew the director, Tina Ramirez, from her old dancing days. So they'd come in and mount ballets, and I'd work with Sally Beattie and Jeffrey Holder and all of these people. So I got this plethora of influences, of dance influences. So, I it was the public school system. So I find it ironic that all these years later, here I am teaching dance in a public school system 3 blocks away from the very school that I learned all this stuff originally. So I've toured the world. I've done Broadway. I've done everything a dancer can do in New York. I've done, basically because I lived here, because all the opportunities were here.
Now tell us about the winter concert that's coming up on Friday. That's tomorrow.
That's tomorrow at 7:30 at our wonderful school. And what I wanted to do with the thing is, a lot of art schools or dance schools concentrate basically on just teaching technique. And then maybe at the end of the year or at the end of 2 years, they do a concert. When the person I told you who was running the dance program before me, he would just do one concert a year at the end of the year. And I thought, no, that's wrong. Dance is a performing art. You should perform it. You should learn how to perform. You can always become a better dancer because dancers train daily. So you can always work on your technique. But I felt that it should be more of a performing art. So I pushed for a winter concert. and which is really soon if you think about it, because the kids start in September and the concert's in December. But I find with a little pressure and a date, the kids, they had something to work for, to work towards. So I found so it was exciting for them to come to school and to have after school rehearsals, and it was a lot of pressure for me and a lot of work. But believe me, it's all a labor of love. So what we're doing tomorrow, we're doing works by Bob Fosse.
So tomorrow is today, isn't it?
No, tomorrow Friday.
For tomorrow Friday.
Yeah.
Good.
Friday.
Okay, Friday. We've been here since after midnight, but it seems like it's that night when you don't sleep.
Yeah, no. Because today is Thursday. No, tomorrow Friday, the 14th. And so I'm doing a Steam Heat from the Pajama Game. We're doing the opening from A Chorus Line by Michael Bennett. It's called I Hope I Get It. And then I've created some original works, and I've had two of the students choreograph works for the dance department as well. I wanted to also instill in my dance students that to be a dancer, to have a career as a dancer, basically is a passive career, because you depend on choreographers, on producers and directors. You kind of depend on everyone else. If you're a choreographer, however, you can go into any kind of dance environment and be in control, since you're creating the work. Also, it's there are a lot more opportunities to teach and choreograph than dance. So I wanted to instill in them that not only can they go out and dance, but they can go out and teach and choreograph.
Well, and that gives you a continuing career too.
Totally. I mean, you know, most dancers that I've known who become teachers teach until they drop dead, you know, until they keel over in the dance studio. And I can see why, because it just stays in your body forever. And your body may change, but what you've learned stays with you. It just stays with you. So so that's what we're doing. I'm also, in February, we're having a benefit to benefit the dance department, so we can put on a huge, splashy spring concert, costumed, you know, with dance shoes and, you know, more of a bigger, better production, more produced. This one is strictly like a chamber concert where we dance, the kids dance, and we invite people to come, and they get the experience of performing for a paying public.
Well, I was lucky enough to see an open rehearsal at the school. And I really recommend that people go and see this. It's inspiring to see young people who have a direction, who are concentrating and focusing on a work, on a discipline. And I think it's really great work that you're doing.
Thanks, Joni. You know, about 10 years ago, this wouldn't have happened, and I wouldn't feel the way I do now, only because now I find we've come full circle and dance is viable again on Broadway. More dance companies are actually holding on to their studios or getting funded. So now it's viable again to be a dancer. After Reaganomics totally just decimated the dance world, and all the whole construction boom in the 80s when they were building all these buildings, so all the prices for dance studios and rentals shot out of the roof, and no one could afford to have their own dance studio. And then a lot of people were dying from the AIDS thing. We were just decimated. I mean, I lived through it, so I saw it. So dancing was not popular. Now it is. Now we have Chicago on Broadway, Fosse, Contact, all these dance-themed shows. So now it's viable again. So I'm really excited. And some of my students, you saw them, Joni, are unbelievably talented.
That's right.
I mean, just unbelievable. I always said
and to
this.
To think
and
that children that had no direction to discover a talent in themselves, that they can really gain discipline and potentially a career.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
It's
yes,
really
yes.
inspiring.
Yeah. Are these mostly kids from the city?
Yeah, they're all inner city kids.
Yeah, it's a New York City public school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's at Town Hall, right in the middle of Times Square. What better place for an art school, I think?
It's really a fantastic location.
Yeah, it's all about locale. It's right there. So I can tell, I mean, they can go out and they can look at the marquees of these theaters, which they, you know, they go to school just a block from, two blocks from, or they can see the photographs outside and see young people like them who are having careers, you know, so it's viable to them. So that's, to me, that's the most exciting part. It's like now it's right again. It wasn't true about 10 years ago, but now it is. We've come full circle. And so they go and they see the posters from Fosse, and they see young dancers, you know, of color in the photographs, which means to the translates to them, this is something that I could possibly do. This is something that I can do. And I still know some people who are still hoofing it out my age in the choruses of these shows, And so I notice people, and then what I'm trying to do, what I want to try to do is bring in some people from these Broadway shows, people I know a few people, and have them share their experiences with my kids on really what it's like out there, the audition scene, and how they can get into a Broadway show.
Well, it was interesting when I first was talking to Marcel about this, and I asked him about the kids and what kind of concerns and problems and issues were foremost in their minds. And he said to me, well, Joni, I'm not a counselor. I'm a dance teacher, and you can't talk while you dance.
You know what's funny is the reaction in the school among the staff and the principal and the vice principal is the fact that the dancers do so well in school. And I said, well, it's obvious. They can't speak while they're dancing. They can't gossip with each other and whatever. So, as soon as they come in, I engage them right away in movement. So you can't talk to your best friend if you're trying to learn a step, a dance step. And that's where I get them. That's where I get their attention. That's where I can hold their attention because it's physical. That's the big plus on my side because I'm not a policeman or a teacher. I'm a dance instructor and choreographer. And I tell them, and I said, I'm treating you, especially my older class, my rep dance company, I treat them just as I would a dance company because I had that experience. I know what it's like. And I want to prepare them for the reality of when they leave school. It's like, this is just how it is. And, for example, Steam Heat has only 3 people in it. But I taught it to the whole class. And I told them, and I said, I want all of you to learn it because you never know. You never know. So yesterday, I casted, the day before, I casted my final 3. I chose the 3 of the class. But one of them was out yesterday. She got ill. So I threw someone else in, and I just pointed it out to the class. I said, you see? God forbid on the day of the concert someone gets stuck in traffic or breaks their leg, whatever. All of you, I want all of you to be prepared because you never know. Life is the X factor. There's that one part of it that you just don't know about it, and you just have to be prepared for. And I think this spills over into reality, into real life, other than just the arts and performing. The one basic thing I want to teach all my dance students is if you show up on time, are prepared, and listen to instruction, you can advance in any career. It doesn't have to be just the arts, and that's discipline, That's teaching them that discipline,
Now, I want you to tell a story about the coverage that you got in El Diario and how that came about.
Okay, so, about a year ago, about this time, I'm sitting at home, it's evening, and I get a phone call. And it's like, I answer the phone, and the person on the side says, hello, my name is Julio Paredes, and I write for El Diario. And I went, okay. And he goes, can you tell me more about your Santa Claus program? And I said, Santa Claus program? What are you talking about? And he goes, isn't this? And then he, gave me my phone number. And I said, yes, that's the correct phone number, but I have no idea what you're talking about. And he had spoken to a homeless man on the street who was playing Santa Claus. He was homeless, but he was in Santa Claus garb. And he gave him the phone number of his organization, but 2 of the numbers were inverted. So the wrong number he got was my phone number. So he said to me, you mean you have nothing to do with Santa Claus or homeless people? And I went, no, I teach at a public school and I run the dance department. And he said to me, well, now that I have you on the line, that seems to be a more interesting story. Tell me. So the fact that I'm Hispanic, I grew up in New York. I went through, public school, and I've had a wonderful career in New York, and that I'm teaching Hispanic and inner-city kids, he thought was an interesting story. So he did a whole page spread, and he came to school and brought a photographer, and the students got their photographs in the paper and all that, so, which was good because last year was my first year. So it really ingratiated me to the student body, the school, parents, and everything. It was like this gift out of the cosmos. It was really a strange
thing.
From
the wrong number.
Yeah, 2 digits off, and they got me. So that's been my catchphrase. I'm just 2 digits off,
All right, so let's run through the information about tomorrow again.
Yeah, it's Public School Repertory Company. We call it PSRC. It's located right at Town Hall. It's the door on the left. And we're on the second floor. The address is 123 West 43rd Street between 7th and 6th Avenues. Town Hall is opposite the theater that's playing Urinetown. There's a Broadway show called Urinetown.
That's right.
We're right across the street. The performance starts at 7:30, and tickets are $15 at the door. It all goes to the dance department, and we use it for the spring concert, for costuming. I also, if we get enough money, I'd like to take the students to a Broadway show so they can see themselves reflected on stage. And like I said, 7:30, 123 West 43rd Street at Town Hall, Friday evening, the 14th.
Do you have a phone number?
Yes. The phone number to the school is 212-382-1875, 1875.
Say that again?
382-1875.
Okay. All right.
Okay.
Great. Anything you'd like to add?
Well, please come. Please come. We really need the support. Especially my rep dancers, my older kids, they're really starting to grasp the art of performance with their bodies and physically and dance. So and it's really worthy. They're so worthy of the monies that we get.
Explain that these kids don't have dance shoes. They don't.
No. Well, right. A lot of them can't even afford dance shoes. So we dance bare feet or in socks or whatever, or if the sneakers they wear don't mark up my floor, I allow them to wear it, you know. But especially my younger kids, a lot of them, their families, you know, they can't afford them, whatever. So we really do need, we're so needy, we really need it. And as you know, 4 days before school started this year, Harold Levy cut $90 million from the school system, and they're about to cut some more as a result of 9/11. So, I mean, I barely have a job there. I barely got in because I was under some other program that was cut. So they found monies for me in another program, and that's how I'm there. But we're struggling. The public school system is struggling, as I think everyone kind of knows.
So you have no budget, really, for the dance department.
There is no budget for the dance department.
So
they
bring
pay
in
me
your
nicely.
Own- They bring in your own music and all that kind of stuff.
Well, everything I spend
that.
On my own.
Right.
I, you know, I buy all the music and I purchase everything, so it's all out of my pocket. And I don't mind doing it, but, I mean, I can't provide dance shoes for every student or proper dance wear and all that stuff. And that's where the need comes in. That's where we need it. And, I really would like to expose them more to a field that they could possibly be in.
All right.
Okay.
Great work, Marcial.
Great.
We really
thank you very
appreciate
much.
Your being with us.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me.
All right.
Good luck.
All right. Have a good day.
Thank
Bye.
You.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo with Miss Joan Marie Moosey. We'll be back in a moment.
PSI needs your support. If you appreciate this radio station, please help keep it thriving. If you have access to the internet, you can show your support online 24 hours a day at www.wbai.org. If you listen, then please do your part to keep WBAI strong. WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. Radio for a changing world.
And you're listening, of course, to WBAI Pacifica Radio in New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo with Miss Joan Marie Moosey.
Hello, hello.
And our number is 212-209-2900. We're here till 6 o'clock. It's 5:29, 1 minute away from 5:30. And
30?
5:30.
New York thing?
It's a New York thing. 5:30. And our number, again, is 212-209-2900. We'll take your calls, Joni and myself. And you're on the radio.
Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hello, hello.
Run to your phone. Anybody but Monroe.
Oh, that's not good.
No, Monroe. You're on. I'm only kidding. Monroe is just like an easy person to joke around with. You're on the radio.
You're a thief, liar, and a hypocrite. You're an incredible.
Are you Howie? Is this Howie?
You're one-sided self-serving.
Are you Howie? Is this Howie?
Unbelievable.
You get up early, yeah. Howie. Where do you go
I'm
work?
John Q. Listener, you're a goddamn fool. You're going to be gone, man. You're going to be gone. You think you're going to be there in a month? Unbelievable. Oh, you Teresa. I don't know why she, quote, resigned, unquote. You are such a liar, Paul. It's unbelievable to listen to your self-serving, self-justifying bullshit attacking
you only have a half hour to say the 7:30 words, so at 6 o'clock you have to stop saying it.
Stop cursing.
You have to stop cursing at 6 o'clock.
Run their pot down.
You know, usually people who curse on the radio have run out of actual logical things to say. That's why they have to curse. No, I thought Al Lewis was a piece of crap.
You're the
I thought it was
crap.
Al Piece of Crap Lewis.
People who are not there to defend themselves.
Al Piece of Crap Lewis.
If they were there, they would be destroying you with their words. You think you're going to be there in a month? You're unbelievable.
Yeah.
One-sided.
I think you're the piece of work,
lying.
Chief.
You're a lying piece of scum. You don't deserve to be on the air.
Oh, another four-letter word.
You're a lying.
Boy, your vocabulary
you're
is growing.
Paul, you're a liar. You're a professional liar. You're a news nothing.
Like, let's see. Amy Goodman, the biggest liar of the bunch.
Why don't you let me talk?
I'd be letting
you're,
you talk.
You're talking like crazy.
You're talking like crazy.
Like a crazy person.
You use your position, your mic, your airtime to defame people who cannot reply to you there. You're a liar. It's your trademark signature of your work, of your morality. You're a liar, Paul.
About what?
About you. Oh, I don't know.
What's
why
a lie?
Retreat resigned. You don't know why retreat.
Well,
she
why?
Was forced out. She was forced out.
Oh, you got the inside information.
You're a mistress. I've been following this. Everybody's been following this. You're an incredible liar.
Why, well, what information do you have that I don't that tells me why Utrecht's lead resigned from Pacifica in Washington?
Because the board wanted to rid itself of the liability.
How do you know that?
Malfeasance.
How do you know that? Well,
logic.
Why do you say that?
Logic.
What do you base that on? Oh, logically you analyzed it. It came like a little saintly bird, dropped it upon your head, the truth.
The board is running scared from the lawsuits.
Yeah, between he's like working on his vocabulary.
Why are they settling, you fool? Why are they settling, you fool?
Because Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez tried to bankrupt the only people who run radio network in the world and handed it over to a judge to run it. So Amy and Juan are responsible for turning over the Pacifica network to the United States government.
Listeners didn't want to send money.
But I don't think you care. I think you really like the United States government.
The boycott against your destruction of the radio station.
Nonsense.
The principles of BAI worked.
It worked in doing what? In sending it? In sending? You're not responding to the issue that I'm raising. It, you know, it sent it to a judge.
To get you out of there.
It sent it to a judge. to a, now every decision that's made by a majority decision that's a simple majority has to go before a judge. But to a judge. It went to it. You're telling me it didn't go to a judge?
He doesn't want to deal with that issue, does he? The judge and the government issue, doesn't he? You don't want to deal with the judge and government issue, do you? No,
government
you
don't. Supervision.
The government supervision of Pacifica because of Amy Goodman's fine work, handiwork of Amy Goodman handing the Pacifica network to a judge. Thank you, sir. You really have nothing more to say?
I have a lot to say.
Well, what about Amy Goodman handing over this network to the government to oversee?
Why don't you put her...
Oh, I see. I should put her on to answer the question about why. Maybe I will. I have nothing more that I would like to do than sit Amy Goodman in front of me and ask her why she put Pacifica in the hands of the government to decide what happens. Oh, so you're saying it's okay? You're supporting the idea of the network being put in the hands of a judge? You are. Are yes or no? Do you know how to say yes or no? That's a three-letter word. It's too many words. Yes or no? Can you answer yes or no? Do you support the judge? He doesn't want to answer it. Let's go on. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Let's see. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Yeah, good morning.
Morning.
Hey, Paul, Joni, I want you to know this is Shabazz in the Bronx.
Oh, hey, how you doing?
Fine, thank you. I want you to know, man, I appreciate your fortitude, your insight, and your intelligence. That's the two of you. And if you need somebody to come down there and slap somebody up, just let me know, because I don't like that guy's attitude.
Attitude. He doesn't even... You have to have intelligence to have an attitude.
You know, it's people like that, you know, that you need to be able to spend a little time, at least a couple of seconds, and let them know how you feel. I appreciate your show. I appreciate your news. And all of that. So
thank you very much.
Nice,
and don't even worry about it. Thank you. I mean, I think it's important to get to this issue because it is, to me, the defining issue of the moment, and that is the fact that the dissidents, led by Amy Goodman, have managed to take Pacifica and put it in the hands of the government and of a member of law enforcement, a judge. So, I mean, I think that is frightening. I think it's a horrible development, and I think it's a shame and a smear and a black mark on Amy Goodman.
Okay, I don't know but a few things, man. I know one thing. I enjoy your show and have a continued good, what is it, morning we have here?
Yeah, we're on.
Hey, listen, I woke up on some good Marty Robbins. Where did that good Marty Robbins come from?
I just, you know, some music. I have a collection of music.
That's
I burned some
good
CDs.
Stuff, man.
Thank you. I love that.
That's my early country and western raising.
I love him, isn't he? He's great music.
Marty Robbins.
Yeah.
All right, check with you later. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right,
bye.
Thanks for calling.
Thanks. And you're on the radio.
Hello?
Hello? You're on there. Hello? You got 25 minutes. No, they gave up. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Well, you got me instead. Be honest about it.
How you doing?
Okay. Regarding the earlier point, caller was talking about you with local politics, the station about WOR. I know that their pay scale, comparatively speaking to other stations, is low. And this is not a sexist remark to make, but one is a matter of fact, that when you see departments that seem to have a disproportionate amount of women, it usually means that the budget is being streamlined because women are not getting the same pay scale, even in this day and age, to their male counterparts,
generally speaking.
And tell me about people being missed. It looks like Bessie Wash is not missed, right, Paul?
I don't know. I actually think that Bessie, Utrice, and the rest of the crew here are really responsible for saving this network because
right.
It was in the hands of people who were destroying it. And I've seen, you know, the documentation, and Joni saw the letter,
yeah.
And we know. We know things that people don't know.
No, I don't disbelieve you on that point.
Point to a extreme to possible personal liability of the previous management of the station.
Well, that's a good way of sticking it to them, I would say. But you know, Utrice is still on board in a greater capacity, but Bessie is no more.
No. Utrice resigned from her job as head of national programming for Pacifica.
Oh.
Yeah, she did, but it was quite an amicable parting, and she is free to come back to WBAI or Pacifica anytime in the future, and that might happen sooner than people think.
Okay, but now I got a question for you. So with BAI right now, you have a station manager, but what's the story with that program director? Has it been eliminated? Or
no, I think that eventually they'll get around to it. But right now, it's an emergency situation. I mean, we just like had the settlement. I mean, I think that might open things up. But you have to understand that I'll give this to the dissidents. They know how to tear down a radio network. You know, blocking phone calls, you know. You have to understand, I just saw a thing, you know, somebody was offering $25,000 matching fund. Somebody was going to pay $25,000 out of their pockets to Carol Spooner to carry on this lawsuit. If we have to raise, you know, that would be $50,000, 25 plus 25, 50. To raise $50,000 here, that means I have to go to 1,000 people over the air and have them give us $50 each. Yeah. So, you know, we don't have the benefit here at Pacifica Radio. We're based on the backs of poor black and Latino people who build the station and who support us. We're not like Amy Goodman or Juan Gonzalez, who makes hundreds of thousands of dollars a year or has budgets of hundreds of thousands of dollars a year. We're not. We don't have connections to people like Steve Brown and others who have personal fortunes and who have made those personal monies available. But I find it interesting the extent to which the so-called left in America is beholden to the rich and to the very wealthy, and how that has led them to, of course, the arms of the government, the judge, the police, to manage a station they could not manage themselves.
Yeah, you know, this sort of, it's very interesting. It's sort of related to what you just said. There's this fellow out now, he was with CBS, and he wrote a book about liberal bias in the media. I don't know if you've seen him. Fox News, of course, is having him on a lot. I think his last name is Goldberg. And the guy's politics happen to be liberal. And he blew the whistle on CBS because he wanted to do a hard-hitting feature on the way CBS covers topics. Like, you know, that show 60 Minutes, for example. You know, they're so nail-biting going after others. But then if they want to be put under the scope, they can't hack it. And I definitely get that impression of some of these people who are now attacking this station.
That's the thing I learned. That's the lesson I learned, you know, that they can dish it out, but boy, oh boy, they can't take it. They could put up 100 web pages attacking me and making personal ugly attacks against programmers here, but somebody can put up half a web page in one little corner with a name a mile long and it reverberates around the world.
Yeah, but you know, when you say the New York Times does some pretty good stuff, well, when you consider their budget, they should be doing some good stuff. And the thing, too, about the New York Times, I'll say this. You know this, of course, because, I mean, you're really gung-ho on this, but, you know, you can get their newspaper free on the web. It's just that you have to log in a subscription right, so they know who you are. And what I find very eclectic and democratic about the New York Times on the web, and I hope it becomes greater in popularity, are these discussion forums on just about every topic. You can log into these forums, and you can respond directly to everybody on the op-ed staff. Like, I'm bombing the hell out of William Sapphire right now.
Isn't that fun?
And they have every international issue. And, like, what I did was, on this site, I republished a 300-word letter that the Times was good enough to publish of yours truly back in 95, slamming Sapphire. Now, the only problem with that is right now it doesn't have the same amount of play as the op-ed, but I could see definitely why they want to police the Internet, because these people are not as protected as they once were, and it works both ways. Like, you make the point about, you know, what they're trying to do, tactics legally. I'm doing it right now myself. I'm dragging a case on for the purpose of getting a settlement my way. And unfortunately, it's something that can be taken advantage of both ways. But, you know, for that matter, too, when you talk about this Hague tribunal going on right now with Milosevic, the freedom to prosecute is free for those who can afford it. And $90 million U.S. taxpaying dollars went to that tribunal, and that's when it quickly degenerated into a NATO kangaroo court. All you have to do is look at the legal backgrounds of the prosecutors and the justices to see this. And also, if you look at today's Pravda on the web, they have an interesting piece discussing how Christopher Hitchens can be called a left-wing neocon. which he is. He really, the reason why you see him.
But, you know, it's you have to understand, you know, the a lot of people would love to use, you know, you can't judge, you can't always judge a philosophy by the people who are expounding it.
Mm-hmm.
You can't always. I mean, the philosophy, I the old saying is Marx's last word on his deathbed was, whatever you do, don't call it Marxism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, it's obviously many people would like to, okay, hang on one second. Obviously, a lot of people would like to judge this philosophy of the people running something, of mass public empowerment, which is a dream of Marxism and of communist revolution, with, unfortunately, some of the loudmouths who've gone around claiming to represent this point of view.
Uh-huh.
And I think that you have to, you know, be very careful. You cannot and at the same time, listen, I'm of the deep belief, and we probably disagree this, that, you know, and I actually disagree very strongly with Bill Weinberg on this, because Bill Weinberg hates communism, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know what he feels now, but all his life I've talked to him, he's hated communism. He's very much an anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I have argued because he wants communism, the worst things associated with communism, gulags, death camps, murders. He wants it all to be associated with the idea of communism, that communism will lead to these horrors all the time. This is what it's about. But in fact, that's not true. What happened was that, in my opinion, when Khrushchev came to power, there was a revisionist shift that in fact led to the creation of what I believe was a social imperialist state, that communism became its opposite. It became fascism under Brezhnev, Khrushchev, Brezhnev, right up through Gorbachev and the rest of these guys. And I do not accept the mandate that it was a communist invasion of Afghanistan, or that the groups in Afghanistan were truly communist groups.
Okay.
No, they just were groups, just like in the United States, people like to, people like the United States used to say we are the guardians of democracy and freedom, and the Soviets would say we are the best, you know, in our own way, and we are truth and justice in the Soviet way.
Yes.
And everybody wants to cloak themselves in these higher aims, even as they're murdering, raping, and ripping off their fellow citizens.
Now, I have a question for you. What do you think of the Stalinist period?
First of all, let me say this, all right? I do not agree with everything that was done in that period. I think great mistakes were made, but I guess I've led on my answer by saying mistakes are made. I do not think that Stalin was a fascist. I do not think that he was ultimately a very progressive man who made a lot of mistakes. But I think that ultimately he was, and I do think that he does represent communism, without a doubt.
Okay, but would you say that he was more...
Unlike Brezhnev or Khrushchev.
So he was more humane than Brezhnev and Khrushchev.
Well, to the mass of people, but not obviously to the middle class. You know, listen, I think a lot of mistakes were made in that era of communism, that we have to find ways, you know, socialists, progressives, people who want to see the empowerment of the workers, have to find ways of... dealing with those people who hate us and disagree with us other than killing them.
Okay, so you don't accept this concept, okay, that in the Stalinist period, these labor camps and people dying...
And I admit it. I take full... You know, I don't take responsibility. I disagree with it, but I fully acknowledge that these things happened.
So you don't see Khrushchev and Brezhnev and Gorbachev as being more progressive in that sense?
Mm-mm. Because they, they are, they stopped persecuting the middle class.
Well, persecuting the lower class, I mean...
The upper classes.
Class as well,
I wouldn't say that. I would say that under Stalin that the lower classes in the Soviet Union were empowered to a great extent. But I think that, obviously, the kulaks, any sort of middle class, small property owner types... were brutally dealt with to the extent that they refused to give in to the ideas of collectivization and socialism and communism. They didn't want to give up. And, you know, you and I have relatives who, like, you know, I'm sure
you know, did things to get out of the country and take their wealth out of the country and everything they owned, you know, to get the hell out of there. You know, they didn't want to give it up.
Well, actually, in my case, my old man, you know, he was on the Western sector at the end of the war, and Stalin had a policy: if you were a POW or if you were a citizen of the Soviet Union, you were in the Western sector, you were under suspicion, which meant, you know, you would go automatically to a camp. Now, what saved my father, ironically, was he was born in Vilnius at a time when it was a part of Poland. So he claimed Polish citizenship, something that he had problems with because, you know, he is a Russian patriot, has had historical problems with Poland, especially the Poland in the 1930s, which was leading, you know, Poland was not invaded in 1939. In its own way, it would have developed into a sort of neo-Nazi-like state. It was heading that way with the death of Pilsudski in 35.
Right. That's, I think that's obvious. I've read a little bit about that history. That's a lot of truth. We don't have that much time to go into that. But you see what I'm getting at, and I see where you're coming from. And I think that we have to find a way to move our societies into the 21st century without having to have camps. And to, like, execute people and to do all these things. You know, obviously, we have to find a better way.
Paul, quickly, the Ford magazine mentioned by that earlier caller, they owned WEVD, their liberal Zionist rag, okay? They basically excuse Israeli policy, so please, they're not progressive at all. If you don't believe me, look them up.
All right.
Take care.
Thank you.
Right.
Bye. All right. Trying to make peace in the Russian Revolution there.
Hey,
you're on the... There you go.
Hello.
Hi.
By the way, what was the name of that singer who did that song... country and western ones is
Marty Robbins.
I love him. Yeah,
oh, he's great.
I love him.
I mean, I've heard that song before. I just never knew his name.
Yeah. He came from somewhere. Yeah. Well, especially El Paso is such a Latin.
Yeah.
You know, it's got a Spanish beat to it, and I think that Marty was like way ahead of his time with that.
Oh, and his instrumental work.
Yeah.
Is
beautiful guitar work.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, everything, the arrangements.
Right. So many people have done that song.
Uh-huh.
I heard El Paso done as a reggae song last night on BAI somewhere.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, and I'd love to find out who was playing it.
Did he write it?
Oh, no, I know. I heard it yesterday afternoon on LIB. I'm sorry,
did Barney Robbins write this too?
I'm not sure. I have it. Like, I burned everything to different CDs so I can play it more easily, so I don't really have the original CD it came from.
I like what you said about the ideologues, you know, the people who get too caught up in their own certainty, you know.
Right.
That's what Hitler was, and that what a Nazis.
The search for truth is what we want to be part of. The search for truth. It's not about the truth.
That's right.
It's about the search for truth, and that's what I'm telling you right now. And I respect the work that Amy's done up till now, but I disagree strongly with the position she's taken. And I think that Amy and her supporters better wake up to the reality that it's not about her holding the truth. It's about the search for truth, and I think that we have to focus on the search for truth and not the truth.
So is the Rashomon, you know, many different angles. And they're all true on some level.
There you go.
I mean, there's just different facets.
I don't think there's a truth out there.
No, I don't think so either. But people get too caught up in their own...
into their own
righteousness.
Yeah, it's cult of personality is a big deal.
Right.
I mean, speaking of Stalin, I mean...
Well, you know, it's human behavior, basically. I mean, that's the fallacy of communism, essentially, is that some big bureaucratic central government can coercively create this false notion of a kind of radical egalitarianism, that everyone is equal, but everyone is not equal, you know. Some people can play a great basketball game. I mean, it's ridiculous. You know, everyone has unique talents and abilities, and you can't homogenize everyone or expect that you need a coercive central authority in order to do that.
There you go. Thank you very much.
Communism.
I think you have a point there. You know, I consider myself a socialist, but you have an important point there. That,
I'm more of a libertarian.
Yeah. Well, listen,
that
I work
government
for,
is the least government.
Right, and I respect that. I'd like to see the government right the wrongs of the past.
Oh, ideally, sure. That's what government should just
but
be.
But we do fear. I mean, obviously, as a libertarian, you understand the fact that that's not always happened.
I hate that label. I mean, I just believe that, you know, people should be, the right to be left alone is paramount, as long as you're not hurting anybody.
I have to say, I feel that way strongly.
Thank you. I think you do. I've heard your philosophy.
It's you know, I like to take the best of socialism and communism and all these anarchism.
Socialism.
And combine them in something new that, like, drops away all the repressive, murderous camp.
I mean, the closest
thing
I've seen is like something like Denmark would be, at least in this world, you know, one of the...
A wealthy country. You know, well, if we could always get all the countries in the world to have a certain amount of wealth, then, you know, then everybody gets mad at me and says I'm against the ecology because the only way to make everybody equal in wealth is to destroy the environment. You know, you can't win.
We're doing a good job of that, I'll tell you that much. Yeah. I mean, we're heading in real dire direction.
Yeah.
The human race is becoming the single greatest threat.
Well, especially...
The life on this planet. We're a victim of our own success.
Yeah, in a lot of ways.
And the reason we kill each other is because we have no natural predators. We're at the top of the food chain, so it's, you know, people find any way.
As we discovered in that book and movie Alive about the plane that crashes in the Andes, where everybody has to eat each other.
Oh, yeah.
All right. It was
like
on top of the food chain, on top of a mountain.
Oh, well.
All right, thanks. We're going to move on.
Good show, Paul.
Thanks
for calling.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And you're on the radio.
Hello?
No, you're not. You're on the radio.
Hello?
Yes, good morning again.
Okay, Myra, we'll keep it quick. We don't have time.
I know. But the point is, I think you're making a mistake when you say there isn't a truth or truths in just the search for. Certainly the search for. Certainly. But not that you can't have the truth. I tried to enter the idea of barter.
Well, let's put it this way. The truth
in Pennsylvania, they put up a barn so other members of the community help. You know, one person puts up a barn, others help. Then the other person needs his barn put up or her barn put up, they help. You don't put money around. So I try to say that the Pacifica Foundation was saying, we're paying these staff members, but the other people are out. They can't be in a union to get health things. They can't get protection.
Not if they're paying. They got to pay. You don't just get health insurance for nothing. You have to pay.
No, but you can pay. It's not exorbitant.
Then they have to raise the money. You see, that's the problem. Is you can't have a self-indulgent show that doesn't raise any money. You know, you can't. And then you want all these benefits that come from having money. I mean, this, you know, you just got to work it out. People have to figure out what they want. Thank you, Monroe. We're going to move on. We don't have much time. You're on the radio.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, how you doing tonight?
All right.
Good. How are you?
All right, good. I think that, you know, we're moving into a new age, basically.
Is that good or bad?
Well... I don't know. I think it's good, actually.
I don't know. Well, good or bad is actually, I think, a narrow construct anyway. Is that? Do you think it's something that we can handle or we're going to fail in handling? Let's put it that way.
Well, I think that we're going to handle it. It's just a question of evolving as a race. You know, basically, I think humanity is changing. I think, you know, the men have really been in charge for a long time, and now the women are going to be in charge.
I hope so. I hope they do a better job of it.
Well, you can see it coming, really.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everything that you look at is more favoring women than it is men. Little by little, more and more.
Well, do you agree with that?
Well, I don't know if it's so much a matter of agree or not agree. I think that it's only a matter of a very short period of time before we have a woman president.
Do you think that's a good idea?
Men have pretty much screwed things up. What do you think?
There you go. Thank you very much. We don't have much time. We're going to move on real quick. Thanks. 212-209-2900, you're on the air.
Hello?
Yes. I have a lot of respect for Amy's scholarship, but I don't know if I agree with where she's going with the station, because I don't know if I know what she's doing. Could you elaborate on the thing?
On who's? I couldn't hear you that well at first. Who's that?
Yeah, Amy Goodman. I have a lot of respect for her scholarship, but I don't know what I should think about what she's doing. Because I don't know what she's doing in regards to this case that she had brought up.
I don't either. I think that Amy is absolutely, months ago, if not years ago, absolutely lost focus about the direction this network should go and these stations should go. She managed to build herself up to a leading role and then squander it on issues that I find hard to understand. And I think that what happens, and how it's been put to me, is that what happens sometimes with a person is that sunrise has arrived. Marjorie Moore is here, about to begin. And let me just answer that by saying that in summation, I was a little bit distracted there for a minute, but let me just say that, let me get my thoughts together. It's about whether losing focus, and that sometimes folks get so involved in the personal aspects of a situation and the personalities that they lose their focus, and they lose the understanding of the reason why they're there in the first place.
I understand that. But what about the case that she has brought against Pacifica?
I think it's a result of that. I think she absolutely became enraged because of program changes that happened that Pacifica had every right to make, and which I believe are going to stand, no matter what happens in California with a judge and holding on, you know, and I think that that she became absolutely she couldn't allow it to stand. She couldn't stay here on the air with under those circumstances with the positions that she took. She put her career and her job on the line to return these folks to the air, but there was no basis. I mean, where was this passion on the part of Amy Goodman for the paid staff when they were being ripped off by Valerie Van Isler?
I don't know.
Where was the passion when we didn't get a raise since 1992? Where was the passion when Samori Marksman was buried and his family didn't have the money for the funeral? Where was her passion when people who were had a right to health insurance didn't get that health insurance? That passion disappeared because she wanted to gather all the funding she could for her show, and she wasn't interested in sharing that funding with the people, the poor, black and Latino people who work here.
I understand that. And
that's what happened.
I really miss Democracy Now. But what is the remedy she was seeking through the court?
Well, I don't know if she was seeking, but I believe that through her support of the boycott of Pacifica, which I believe she supported and was the leading factor behind, they created a situation where they had to settle and create a situation where the judge now is going to decide the issues. A judge in California is going to decide the future of this network and this station.
You know, I think we should have a cooling off period and some mediation to see if we can reminisce amicably among ourselves, because there are certain programs that are not on the air now that are really worthwhile programs. I think Democracy Now! Was a wonderful program.
Yeah, but, you know, you can't separate the program from the person. If the person doesn't want to be here because they don't want to accept the reality of how the place is run, and they decide instead to try and overthrow and destroy the institution because they can't get their way and throw a hissy fit over it, you know, then they sacrifice their show. She lost focus. It was her fault. She's not on the air through her own actions.